Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 626. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about Churchill and Patton and Hitler, the movies The Battle of the Bulge, Band of Brothers, and A Bridge Too Far, as we go to Europe on the Liberation Route. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Let's talk about the liberation of Europe in World War II. I'd like to welcome back to the show Gary Arndt, who has come to talk to us this time about the Liberation Route in Western Europe. Gary, welcome back to the show after a very brief hiatus this time.
Thank you. I think this is show number 14 for me.
It is. Well, we didn't want to leave it on 13 for very long. I'm about to travel, including the Amateur Traveler trip, where I'll be traveling with some of you. And so I'm trying to get a number of shows in the can. And Gary had just done the trip that we did an episode about two episodes ago now on Switzerland. But you did this trip before that. So we're actually doing these a little out of order in terms of how you did it. But this is an interesting trip, especially as we're recording here in 2018, because there's some big anniversaries coming up here in 2019.
75th anniversary of the Normandy invasion, which will be a big to-do. That's part of the Liberation Route that we'll be talking about.
Now, I had not heard of the Liberation Route, so tell me what it is.
It's relatively new. What it is kind of a consortium and a collection of sites that are dedicated to the history of World War II, in particular, the liberation of Europe. So we're talking about sites that deal with 1944 and 1945. And most people are familiar with this from the various movies, because this was the part of the war that the Americans were involved in. And this is Saving Private Ryan, A Bridge Too Far, The Battle of the Bulge, all these things,
right,
which most people don't realize, all took place in an 11-month period.
Right, sure.
June 44 to May 45, that was VE Day, and it was less than a year. So the Liberation Route stitches all these things together. And like I said, it's still rather new. And what they're attempting to do is to sort of provide some sort of narrative cohesion to all of these different places, which up until recently have been separate museums, cemeteries, right, battlefields that you could visit. I think even in their future plans, they even may want to make this a Camino de Santiago type route. It's a lot longer than that. I think from Normandy to Berlin, you're looking at 3,000 kilometers. So it'd be something that you could bike. And if it was a bicycle route, it would take about the same amount of time as the Camino de Santiago as you would hiking it, which is about 30 days.
You did this as a road trip.
Right. So this was about 17 days for me, starting in London and ending in Berlin. So I condensed into 17 days what took the Allies 11 months.
And a lot more losses.
But yes.
Now, you started in London. Is that where the actual start of the route is, or does it start at the South Coast?
This is a collection of places. So there isn't one linear path that you necessarily have to go on.
Okay.
In London, you have sites that I'm sure you've talked about on other shows, and you may have been to some of these. The Imperial War Museum.
Imperial War Museum, yeah.
Yeah, being the biggest one. And then also
Cabinet War Room.
Yeah, where Churchill.
Sure, yeah, okay.
And if anyone saw the recent movie about Churchill, Darkest Hour, I think some of that was actually shot there.
It sure looked like it was. If it wasn't shot there, it was shot in a very good recreation of it. And of the two British World War II movies that came out this year, Dunkirk and Darkest Hour, it's the one I would highly recommend.
I like Dunkirk too. The plot was very thin.
Yes.
But I thought the cinematography and everything else was really good.
Cinematography was good.
But so London is kind of where things got ready, right? For the, the planning for the invasion of Europe. I don't know if you're familiar, so if you've ever seen the movie Patton, but they basically had Patton in Northern England with a fake army. And they did all of this counter-espionage to make the Germans believe that we had this army that didn't exist that was basically going to cross over at Dover, which is the narrowest point in the English Channel.
To Calais, yeah.
That was actually turned out to be really important because Hitler and a lot of high-ranking Germans, they thought that that's what the Allies would do. And they thought that the Normandy invasion was just a diversion. And so they did not move troops to Normandy because they thought that the real invasion would happen in Calais.
Well, and I remember one of the major things that happened is Hitler reserved for himself the positioning of the Panzer units, of the tank units, and they couldn't move them without his authorization, and he delayed for several days. I don't remember exactly how long it was, but it was a critical time period that allowed the Allies to get a foothold, basically, in Normandy, while he was still convinced that, no, they wouldn't do it without Patton, and they wouldn't do it where they were doing it. That's got to be a fake. And of course, if you see the videos of the tanks, for instance, of the inflatable tanks that they were using, that the Germans were taking pictures of Patton's fake army, it is just fascinating.
So I don't want to dwell too much on London. I think if you've done shows on London, it's probably the one place on this list that most people will have been.
Right.
But from London, I then went to Portsmouth in southern England, which, just as an aside, is a really wonderful city.
I have not been to Portsmouth, but I, as a history fan, as a British naval fan, it's embarrassing that I haven't been there.
It's a great little town. I was there on a wonderful day in the summer on the coast. It was beautiful. And this was one of the launching points for the ships in Operation Neptune. And just a point of clarification, Operation Overlord was actually the code name for the entire invasion of Europe.
Yeah.
Operation Neptune was the name for the amphibious landing on D-Day itself.
I did not know that. Okay.
I didn't know that either until this trip. Overlord was kind of, and that's what's used.
Yeah.
Because of the greater thing, but the specifics of the beach landing craft and that element of it, that was a subset of Operation Overlord. And Portsmouth has the D-Day Museum, which is not a big museum, but it's a very nice museum. And they also have a very interesting thing called the Overlord Embroidery.
Okay. Is this like the Bayeux Tapestry, except much more recent?
Yeah, the Overlord Embroidery. So it was a work of art commissioned in the 1960s. 1968, and it is 83 meters long, and it was done by the Royal Embroidery Society in the UK. And each panel of it depicts a different aspect of D-Day, whether it's the soldiers and the ships or Churchill and Montgomery and all these sort of different things. And it was initially, like I said, commissioned in 1968, took several years to do. Went on tour in Canada and the United States for a long time until it eventually found a home in Portsmouth, which is its permanent home today.
Huh.
But it's a really impressive work of art in just the size and scope of it. It was commissioned by a man who was a businessman. He was a veteran of D-Day and wanted it commemorated. And it's really one of the best artworks that I've seen that deals with World War II.
Huh.
And the embroidery is in the same location as the D-Day Museum in Portsmouth, so you can visit them both at the same time, and well worth the visit.
Okay.
And then from Portsmouth, you follow the route of the Allies, and you cross the English Channel to Normandy. Of course, you just do it with a ferry. You don't have to land on the beach, and you arrive in Cannes. And that's kind of the major city, which is the hub for a lot of the sites in the Normandy region. And this is the one part of the liberation route that I think most Americans will probably be familiar with. If they visited any World War II sites, they probably went to Normandy and visited these places. So there's five different beaches where the Allies landed, strung out over a pretty sizable section of the coast. Two were American beaches, two were British beaches, and one was a Canadian beach. So the American beaches were Utah and Omaha. Mm-hmm. The Canadian beach was Juneau, and the British beaches were Sword and Gold. And the biggest museums are definitely on the American beaches. I think they draw the most tourists, although there is a very good museum on the Canadian beach as well that I visited on Juneau Beach that tells the Canadian story. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing also is that the entire staff of the Canadian Museum is staffed by Canadians.
Okay.
So they bring people in who are bilingual in French and English. That's who runs the museum. And I should note that in this discussion, we'll be talking about a lot of different museums. They all tell the same story, at least in the initial stages, because most museums, their stock and trade is going to be school groups and things like that.
Right, sure.
So it's going to be local kids, and they kind of give the background of World War II, how it happened. They may actually start with World War I. But each museum is different in that they always tend to give a local twist to talk about what happened in that area. So, for example, the Memorial de Cannes is a very big museum in Cannes, mm-hmm. and talks about a lot of the World War II background. But then they get into like the French Resistance, how that worked, the Vichy government, things like that. And when you're in the museums in Belgium, they talk about the Belgian Resistance. When you're in the Netherlands, they talk about the Netherlands Resistance. And then also the Fascist Party, their equivalent that exists in the Netherlands, actually. They kind of try to tell the whole story. So everything kind of has that basic theme, but then everything else is a little bit different. The Cannes Museum is fantastic, certainly the biggest museum I visited in this entire trip, simply because I think they get the most visitors. So the Utah Beach Museum really goes into detail about not just the D-Day landing itself, but that beach. And, okay. and the interesting thing about these World War II museums, that if you, let's say we're talking about some battle that the Romans fought, like the Battle of Cannae or something like that, we know who the generals were. Mm-hmm. We have no idea who the individual soldiers were, right? And so much of that has been lost. Mm-hmm. And one of the interesting things about visiting all these places is that it's still recent enough where there are still some veterans who are survivors of the war.
Sure. Decreasing numbers, but yeah.
True. But and many of them are around for a long time where mm-hmm. we've have interviews with them. We have all the original stuff. And a lot of times we know the story of on this particular hill at 128, this soldier and these guys did this.
Right.
They attacked this bunker. There's a level of detail that you're going to get here that you're just not really going to be able to get in any other war, simply because we have so much more information, so many artifacts, and so many people's stories.
Hmm. One thing while you're paused here, the tapestry, getting back to the Overlord tapestry, I did look up to see whether there was any parallelism to the Bayeux tapestry, which was made to commemorate the invasion of William the Conqueror into England. And this tapestry that's made, or this embroidery that's made about the English coming back in the other direction. And the Lord Dulverton, who was on the commissioning committee, did give a speech where he said, basically, it focuses on one history and explicitly important campaign to which the world conflict had led and made possible, and the Bayeux tapestry, nearly 900 years before D-Day, certainly beckoned it to be made. So it did seem like they were inspired by that idea, and they made it 10 meters longer than the Bayeux tapestry, I think probably intentionally.
So Omaha and Utah Beach have good museums. Then you also have St. Mère-Église. So the village of St. Mère-Église, this was the village where the paratrooper famously got stuck on the church tower. Mm-hmm. And to this day, they have a mannequin and a parachute hanging from it. So I thought that was interesting. And another interesting thing is that the parachutist who got stuck on that tower, and I think that was in the movie The Longest Day, his name was John Steele.
Okay.
So he was a man of steel. And guess what town he was from?
He was from Kansas, then?
He was from Metropolis, Illinois.
Oh, no.
I kid you not. He survived the war and visited several times after the war was over, coming back to the city before he passed away. And there's also an airborne museum in St. Mary Glise. There's a lot of little museums that you'll find all over Normandy, most of which are kind of private.
Mm-hmm.
I went in and visited the Airborne Museum as well, which was also kind of interested. And that just focused, again, on the experiences of the paratroopers. So they had a glider, an original glider mm-hmm. from World War II that was there. And boy, would that be a horrible experience. You thought parachuting was bad, but most of these gliders, even if they made it safely, they still kind of crashed.
Oh, yeah. I remember seeing all the pictures from my history books. And yeah, it seemed like that was as good as it got, was a crash landing. Well, the other thing, you mentioned St. Mary Glise. That's also then the first town to be liberated.
No, I think you're right, because it was liberated before the invasion started.
By the paratroopers.
By like an hour, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think it was like 5 a.m. it was liberated.
Mm-hmm.
And the invasion, I think, started at 6:20. And the other amazing thing I learned about this was how well synchronized this all was.
Sure.
And we don't think of World War II as having, they didn't have GPS or atomic clocks or anything. But the last bombing run by the fighter bombers on the barracks on the coast were done 2 minutes before the troops hit the beach.
Hmm.
And they had to really time that extremely well in order for, so there wasn't any friendly fire casualties. But yeah, St. Mary Glise was liberated by the paratroopers who landed the night before the amphibious assault began.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason I was questioning it is because near Juno Beach, where the Canadians landed, there are literally houses on the beach.
Yes.
And they took that over within 20 minutes.
Yeah, that one was not the same kind of fighting you saw in Saving Private Ryan. That was more on the U.S. beaches that landed at the base of cliffs and things like that.
And if somebody goes there, one of the other things I would recommend is, so they had a timetable. It's like, okay, we land on mm-hmm. D-Day, and then we have X number of days to do the following. And the problem they encountered were the hedgerows.
Yes.
All of these farms. Go and actually drive down one of these really narrow roads, because you can see these hedgerows built up over centuries, right? These were the dividing areas between the farms.
Mm-hmm.
And what ends up happening is that the soil and the growth of these things builds up. And so the roads between them, they're like in a valley.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very narrow, basically one lane. And I accidentally, because I took a wrong turn, went down one of these. And I was like, oh, wow. So these are the hedgerows. I can see what happened. And so they were behind their timetable to get to Cherbourg, their first big goal, because from there they could use the ports
right.
to then start resupplying everything else. So I think they were 2 weeks behind in liberating Cherbourg. But once they got through that marshy, swampy hedgerow area, they ended up liberating Paris ahead of schedule. So that was supposed to be done 90 days after D-Day and ended up a month sooner almost.
Hmm. I didn't realize it was that much sooner.
Because you learn so much about this, the logistics of D-Day was perhaps the most incredible thing.
Mm-hmm.
The logistics often get overlooked. I don't know if you've ever heard the expression that amateurs talk about tactics and professionals talk about logistics.
Yeah.
Basically, they had these thing called Pluto piers, I think what they were. And these were they basically created temporary harbors.
Right.
And there are still some remains out near the British beaches that you can see.
Oh, really?
And some other wooden metal bits that are on the beaches in some other parts. But basically, they ended up using those a lot longer than they thought. And even after they liberated Cherbourg, because damage to the port there. And there was a system I hadn't heard of called the Red Ball Express, which was the highway, basically, to get all the logistics and equipment mm-hmm. and food and everything else. So it was like a one-way highway that they created from the loading points, and it just kept going further north as the troops advanced. And the Red Ball Highway, listening to the stories, I mean, I don't know if it would make a great movie, but basically a lot of these truck drivers, which is what they were, often African-Americans,
mm-hmm.
were driving very high speeds for what these trucks could do for 16 to 18 hours a day. They'd get very little sleep, and they had to get to the supplies. The final thing to probably talk about would be the cemeteries. Mm-hmm. The Normandy American Cemetery is by far the most popular one, but there's also a German war cemetery, and I actually visited two German cemeteries on this trip. Mm-hmm. And if you go to its German cemetery is in La Cambe. It doesn't get a lot of visitors for obvious reason. The tombstones are kind of like a Gothic cross, and they have three names on each tombstone, as opposed to the American cemetery where every soldier gets their own. Mm-hmm. One to the right, one to the left, one to the middle. And it's very interesting. And they have an inscription at the cemetery. Just to paraphrase it, it's basically, you know, here lies a lot of people who are on the wrong side of history, fighting a cause that for many of them was not theirs.
Interesting.
It's kind of a bit awkward, but...
Well, I've been to the German cemeteries in Belgium after World War I. And the interesting thing there is that there's not very many American cemeteries because the Americans had the right to bring the bodies home. If the family wanted to, they would pay to bring it home. There's quite a lot of British cemeteries and Commonwealth cemeteries because that was not the rule in the Commonwealth. Commonwealth was you could not bring the body home, and they were given the land for the cemeteries. They basically paid for those cemeteries in defense of Belgium in blood, and the Germans released the land, and over time, the leases would run out and they would consolidate. And so I went to a relatively small cemetery that was a German cemetery, but I think it held a crypt with 20,000 remains of German soldiers, but in a very, very tight space.
The German cemeteries were kept in good shape, but obviously they don't get as many visitors. Mm-hmm. There's no museum or anything like that, whereas the American cemeteries are really done well. A little further up the route, I actually got to visit the cemetery, the American cemetery in the Netherlands. And there's only one in the Netherlands. And I met the superintendent and learned all about the American Battlefields Monument Commission, which I didn't know a whole lot about. Mm-hmm.
The people in charge of all of the foreign cemeteries or all the cemeteries for U.S. soldiers?
All of them.
All of them, yeah.
So there's some in Asia. I know there's some in the Philippines and then quite a few in Europe. They keep very good care of it. Mm-hmm. While I was there, they were power washing some of the headstones. So they're made sure that they're kept very, very clean. Mm-hmm. They don't get dirty. They don't let anything grow on it. And I know in the cemetery in the Netherlands, it's next to a smaller town, and it's not nearly as big as the Normandy one, mm-hmm. that it's a tradition that a family will adopt several of the headstones. Mm. And then once or twice a year, they will go there and wash it, plant some flowers, things like that.
Hmm. Interesting.
This is probably a good time to mention the big difference. You know, as an American, we talk about World War II. We talk about it in the abstract because it didn't happen here. And the big difference I found is when you're there, I had one guide who literally, okay, in Band of Brothers, this is the intersection and this is the house. And one house still had bullet holes that they never fixed. I saw foxholes from the Battle of the Bulge. And then most importantly, all the stuff. So we talk about the industrial capacity of the United States in World War II and all the tanks and all the planes that we built. All that got flown over to Europe. And then we left it there. So there's museums that have a fantastic collection of World War II equipment. So we can move on now from Normandy. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Bastogne, or as a lot of Americans say, Bastogne, in Belgium, which was the focal point of the Battle of the Bulge. And we're kind of going temporally out of sequence here, because the Battle of the Bulge actually occurred in December of 1944 and January. And some of the sites later occurred earlier, but we're going in a straight line, not to backtrack. And this was a very interesting site as well, because again, there was a movie, Battle of the Bulge. I think it came out in the 1960s.
Also, the movie Patton covers part of that.
Correct. They have a very good museum, really from just an interpretive standpoint, one of the better ones I've seen, and they do some really clever things. But I also went out. We had a guide from the museum, and this is where he literally showed me like some of the foxholes that are still there. And it was on the side of a road, and there's all these trees because it's in the Ardennes forest. Mm-hmm. And I'd never been to this part of Belgium before. I'd always been to Ghent, Brussels, Antwerp.
Right. You're almost in Luxembourg at this point.
Exactly. So I'd never been to this part, and it's very hilly, mm-hmm. very thickly forested. And you could definitely see how they were all these ditches along the side of this road. Over time, these foxholes will disappear because that's what holes do in the forest. But you can definitely see where they were still there. And the famous quote from the Battle of the Bulge.
The short quote?
Yes. From General Anthony McAuliffe. The Germans asked him for a surrender. And his reply back was, "Nuts." And the story behind it was actually interesting, because when one of his officers said, "Oh, we got a request to surrender," he just sort of said, "Ah, nuts." As in like, "Oh, that's a bad thing." And that's what they ended up sending back. It wasn't like necessarily a purposeful thing. The primary Battle of the Bulge Museum is in one spot. Mm-hmm. But then if you go into town, into Bastogne, they have the barracks, which was the headquarters for General McAuliffe during the battle. And there they have the actual rooms where the staff was. It's actually a Belgian army facility right now, but it's not really active. I mean, the primary thing they do is restore old military equipment. But they have a garage there that has the biggest collection of World War II machinery I have ever seen. And they have an example of every tank, jeeps, cranes, amphibious vehicles, you name it. It's really impressive. So if you're kind of a general history buff, definitely go to the museum. But if World War II is really your thing, make sure to actually go to the barracks in Bastogne to check out this collection, because it's really fantastic. And McAuliffe Square is the main square in the town. It's where a lot of the tourist activity and a lot of the hotels are. Mm-hmm. And there was actually a cafe there called the Nuts Cafe.
Of course there is. We talked about the movies that talk about this particular conflict, also Band of Brothers, because yes. That would be about the 101st Airborne, and General McAuliffe is the general from the 101st Airborne. So
as we move forward, we're now kind of going into the Netherlands. I should also add that where these locations are where there were battles. So there wasn't a whole lot in northern France, because there just wasn't a lot of battles in northern France. Mm-hmm. Once they had that breakout from Normandy, the units moved quite rapidly. The Germans abandoned Paris and they retreated north. So there's not a whole lot of sites in northern France in that area where there are a lot of World War I sites. Mm-hmm. So I remember driving north to Bastogne, passing Verdun and
right, sure.
a lot of these famous sites from World War I. So if you wanted to make it a World War I, World War II combo trip, plenty of opportunities to do that in France as well. Mm-hmm. We were talking about Band of Brothers, and a big part of that was Operation Market Garden. And a lot of what you're going to find in the Netherlands deals with that. Now, Operation Market Garden was a plan by Field Marshal Montgomery. I wouldn't necessarily call it a huge success, but it was kind of
The book and movie are a bridge too far, so that will give you some clue.
I'll be talking about that, because I actually went and rewatched A Bridge Too Far while I was in the Netherlands to catch up on it. But yeah, that's a good summary of it. Basically, what they wanted to do was go along one highway, mm-hmm. drop paratroopers into the several bridges to take them, mm-hmm. so they could then move the rest of the army up through this to kind of thrust into the Netherlands. And once they were across the Rhine, to then hopefully move quickly into Berlin. And it didn't quite happen that way.
Right, because every time they came to a river, the Germans wanted to blow the bridge to slow them down, hence the movie The Bridge at Remagen. So we got a lot of movie references in this particular one.
It's a great way for people that may be their best understanding certain events in World War II. So we're in the Netherlands, and the first museum is the Overloon Museum. And I didn't know a whole lot about the Battle of Overloon, but it was primarily fought by the Americans and the Germans. And here, too, a really great collection of stuff. They have so much equipment, and not just trucks, but uniforms, helmets, guns, ammunition, sea rations, all the kind of miscellaneous things that nobody would ever bother to save that they have in this museum. And I spent several hours there in the morning, and I could have spent a lot more time. They even had one guy who donated, well, I shouldn't say he donated, it's on loan. He collects artillery shells. Okay. And he has this amazing collection of the actual munitions. And I think he's going to start his own museum or something small eventually, but it was there when I was there. They just had so much. And again, Overloon, not a very big town, but an important battle happened there and a fantastic, fantastic museum.
So you're in southeast corner of Netherlands at this point, really close to Germany. Yeah, I don't know this battle either.
Yeah, it wasn't a huge one. And then I went to the Vught concentration camp. And I always have trouble with any Dutch word with V, with a G in it. The Vught concentration camp, oddly enough, so it was not a death camp like mm-hmm. Auschwitz.
Well, Auschwitz was a work camp too.
But they didn't have gas chambers.
Yep, got it. Like
they did kill people, usually through firing squad or hanging. But it was not that kind of camp. It was a detention center. Jews and other people were certainly brought there. But it was also just political dissidents mm-hmm. and things like that who were brought to this camp. And the really weird part is that the camp was a rather large facility. After the war, a bunch of it got actually turned into housing.
Huh.
For some refugees from Indonesia who ended up coming to the Netherlands. And a prison. And it is still a prison today. So right outside the museum front door, if you turn to the right, that's the gates of the prison. So the former concentration camp is today a prison. And it's really weird going there and hearing the stories of all these people who were imprisoned. And then right outside the door is a prison. There isn't a whole lot there. There's one building, which was the crematorium, which still exists. But all of the bunkhouses and things like that have either been repositioned in a different part of it or been torn down. The Vught camp was something that I was not that aware of. I mm-hmm. think we're more aware of the things that happened in Poland and in the East.
Yeah.
But I remember seeing some of the museums in the Netherlands. And after liberation, there was, of course, a lot of shaming and attacks on people who were considered sympathizers.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember this photograph of this one man who basically had a sign that says, I was a hangman at Vught.
Hmm.
So it was really powerful. Next, I went to the town of Best, and they had the Wings of Liberation Museum. Here, too, another amazing collection of equipment, including aircraft and as well as some tanks. And I went to the Canadian Cemetery in Rosbeek, and I'm probably butchering that one. And there's also the National Liberation Museum is there. And then I ended this particular day in the town of Nijmegen. Nijmegen, if you do any sort of World War II stuff in this trip,
mm-hmm.
the one thing you absolutely must do, and this was the top experience I had on the liberation route, was in the town of Nijmegen, they do every single day something called the Sunset March.
Okay.
So if you've seen the movie A Bridge Too Far,
mm-hmm.
Robert Redford has to cross the river in canvas boats to go take the opposite side of a bridge. And they are not equipped for this. They didn't even know where the boats were. They had no paddles, so they're using the butts of their rifles. And the entire way, all he just kept saying is, Hail Mary, full of grace, Hail Mary, full of grace. And 48 men were killed on this assault. So when they built a new bridge several years ago, in 2013, they put 48 pairs of lights across the bridge.
Hmm.
And every single night, they have a veteran who marches across the bridge at sunset when the lights turn on to honor the 48 men who gave their life in the town of Nijmegen. And anybody can show up. There were about 6 or 8 people when I was there. They have 30 different veterans in town who share the duty, so like one day a month. But other veterans groups can show up if they want, and they can do it as well. There's always a veteran at the front of the march who does it. And even if no one's there, even if it's inclement weather, they have somebody who does it. And when I first heard about this, I was questioning. It's like, World War II veterans? They're just any veterans. So the guys who were there the day I did it were actually veterans of the Bosnia campaign.
Hmm.
where they had Dutch peacekeepers. But they've had many Americans who are veterans show up, as well as veterans from other countries. The actual walk across the bridge doesn't take long. It's about 12 minutes. Just make sure you're there at a little bit before sunset to do it, because it's an amazing trip. And the other thing I should mention about Nijmegen, because this is another thing I did not know about. There were about 800 people killed in Nijmegen from a bombing run by Americans. Mm-hmm. We accidentally bombed the wrong town. What happened was, is that there was a mission that the Americans went on in Germany, and they couldn't reach the target. And their orders were that they were to attack, if they found any targets of opportunity, that they were to unload their payload on that. Well, they didn't realize that Nijmegen was in the Netherlands, and they thought it was a German city, and they bombed it without, I don't think there was an air raid siren or anything, and it was kind of in the middle of the day. The entire school got wiped out, and it was one of the biggest, friendly single fire. Biggest things that happened in the war to the Netherlands. It's the single biggest catastrophe, and it was friendly fire, yeah.
And when you say they didn't realize it was in the Netherlands, it's about 2 miles from the border to downtown Nijmegen. So it'd be easy to see without GPS and detail maps and flying in the dark. Oh, well, I guess this daylight run, how you would make that mistake. But still, yeah, there was a lot of friendly fire things that we don't hear that much about.
That's a bit of history that is not discussed. And so I got to walk around the city with one man who was a child when this happened, and the city was really devastated. Not a lot of Dutch cities necessarily were, but Nijmegen was. From there, we went to Arnhem, and Arnhem was the location of the bridge too far.
Right.
This was the bridge that crossed the Rhine. And there's a very small museum right near the water. It's really not very big, but you're very close to the bridge. The bridge that's there now is in basically the same location as the former bridge, but the bridge from World War II was destroyed by the Germans when they retreated, so that's not there anymore. The other major place in the Netherlands that I would mention is the concentration camp Westerbork. So this is a bit further north, and this was a transition camp for Jews who were being sent from the Netherlands and Belgium and other places to sites in the east. And it was originally designed as a holding place where Jews were told to come there, and then eventually as they were rounded up and arrested, they would come here and then be shipped off somewhere else. And this is actually where Anne Frank was briefly before she was shipped off to another facility. And they have a very good museum here talking about the Holocaust and what happened in the Netherlands and the Dutch perspective on it and the people that were lost and exactly what happened. Location of the camp is about, I want to say, 2 kilometers from the museum. So they do have a shuttle bus, and that's how you have to get there. But it's really not hard because they're running the bus constantly.
Yeah.
The next big stop was in the town of Schmidt, which is in Germany. And this was a location for one of the biggest battles of World War II that a lot of people don't know about. In terms of the cost of American life, I think it was the largest battle in the European theater, and that's the Battle of Hütten Forest.
Okay, only vaguely familiar.
Right. I don't think there was a movie made about it.
Exactly.
I don't know the logic for why they attacked here, because it was a very hilly area, very forested area, so it didn't really lend itself to offensive maneuvers. But here I could actually see part of the Siegfried Line, which was the defensive line built in Germany. It was kind of their version of the Maginot Line.
Mm-hmm.
And today what you can probably see are these things called dragon's teeth, which were cement pyramids, mm-hmm. like a trapezoid that were designed to stop tanks.
Right.
So very difficult for them to drive over. So as part of what we did, we also visited a camp, or it's a facility called Vogelsang, which the best I can describe it is it was like West Point for Nazis. They had, I think, 4 of these facilities that they intended to build, but it wasn't a military academy per se. It was more of a political place where they wanted upcoming National Socialist leaders to be trained and indoctrinated.
Hmm.
So it's actually a very picturesque place. really evokes all these Wagnerian, Teutonic type things that the Nazis were big into. But yeah, it was basically a training facility. And then after the war, I think it was a army base for the Belgian army. And Belgians basically gave it up. And now it's a tourist place where people can visit, has a museum. And the museum is really interesting because it's not the typical World War II museum. It really gets in depth about how this facility was used by the Third Reich, what it was intended for, and then what a lot of the graduates here who ended up becoming the masterminds and the people that actually implemented a lot of the Final Solution. Because a lot of the hardcore Nazis all came from this facility or places like it. This is where the super hardcore Nazis went. And it's available to the public now. And I think Hitler actually was there a few times for like graduation ceremonies or something. But it's really kind of worth visiting. It's technically not part of the liberation. Mm-hmm. It was very close by and definitely worth seeing. And then from there, the final stop was in Berlin itself. And it was, I think, quite a drive to get from the little town of Schmidt to Berlin. And the one thing in Berlin is the Allied Museum.
Oh, and I didn't know this.
Yes, the Allied Museum is in the former West Berlin, and it is built in the movie theater of what was a U.S. base at the time. So this was where the Americans had a movie theater. And it talks about the Allied occupation of Berlin and how that was in four different sections and how they all dealt with each other. And then also that museum sort of transitions into the beginning of the Cold War, where they talk about the Berlin airlift and things like that. And there's actually, I think, one of the planes that participated in the Berlin airlift is there. Because it's in an old theater, it's not an enormous museum. But if you're going to be in Berlin anyhow, it's definitely well worth it. It's not like in the central part of Berlin at all. It's in more of a residential area. But again, it gives a very different perspective from all the other museums in that it focuses really on that ending point, the occupation of Berlin, and then going forward. So you kind of have everything in the places I just mentioned. The start and the planning of D-Day in England, the actual landing, Operation Market Garden, the Battle of the Bulge, the Battle of Hürtgen Forest, and then VE Day and the occupation of Berlin.
Excellent. Now, you said that there is also going to be a liberation route from coming in from the east.
If you go to liberationroute.com, they have a list of all of the sites that are currently part of the liberation route, and there are a few of them in Poland, but I think that most of the emphasis right now is definitely on Western Europe, simply because there's been more development of the museums and things like that. So actually, yeah, if you go to the website and look at the locations from the countries I mentioned, there's also Italy has a couple, Poland has two, I think there's one in Luxembourg, and a ton in the Netherlands. And it was originally a Dutch-led, well, it still is a Dutch-led project. Because I think there's so many of the sites that the area of Operation Market Garden and then Normandy are the two big hubs of everything.
Okay, interesting. What surprised you?
Just a lot of the things I just mentioned. That it was Operation Neptune was the actual D-Day code. Because I always thought it was Overlord.
Yeah.
The amount of logistics. I've been doing a lot of reading the last couple of months about World War II. And one of the things that a lot of historians have noted is that the Americans weren't necessarily the best fighters. At the start of World War II, we didn't have an army, basically.
Not very big, yeah.
No, well, it wasn't much. And we had really three things going for us. An incredible industrial capacity that couldn't be touched by the enemy.
Right. There was an ocean away, right?
We were very good at adapting and learning. Whereas, say, the Germans and the Japanese had a very hierarchical structure, and you could never go to a commanding officer and say, hey, you know, this didn't work, let's do something else, where the Americans were much more open to that. So if something didn't work, like our first battles in North Africa did not go well at all.
No, they didn't.
But we adapted quickly. And there was a lot of that adaptation that as the war went on, I think we got better. And then the third is logistics. The American soldiers were better fed, better equipped.
Well, better equipped, not in terms of the quality of any one tank, for instance, but that there were more of them. you couldn't put a Sherman tank versus a Tiger tank and expect it to win. But if you put 20.
There was a great book I recently finished called The Second World Wars, plural, that really takes more of an economic perspective. And one of the things they looked at were German tank production.
Mm-hmm.
And they made very good tanks. And
oh, yeah.
German machine guns were actually really good. But then they looked at what was the amount of labor that went into making one of these and the amount of material. And it was just really enormous compared to what the Americans, or especially the Soviets, were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Soviets didn't even bother to lacquer the butts of their rifles.
Hmm.
They just wanted to crank stuff out and get it in people's hands. Whereas the Germans were focused on quality, the Americans were really more focused on quantity. And there was one quote from a German soldier, some anonymous German soldier, that was shocked that when the Americans, like a Jeep or something, got damaged, they would just abandon it and get a new one.
Right.
And the Germans, we got to fix it. We don't have a lot of vehicles. But the Americans had so much stuff coming in,
right,
especially into 1945, that was their attitude. It's just like, don't stop. Just leave it on the side of the road and keep going.
Well, and versus you mentioned the Russians not bothering to lacquer the butts of the guns. I remember as they're sending troops into Stalingrad, and in the book Enemy at the Gate, they were talking about the soldiers coming across the river and they've only got a gun for every other soldier. Everybody gets 5 bullets and every other person gets a gun, and they're basically told, don't worry, guns will be available. It's like, yeah.
When the guy next to you dies,
exactly.
Take his gun. The other thing I learned is being able to physically be there and to see the sights and to see the things. For example, the town I grew up in, I think we had in one of the squares, there was a memorial, and I think we had a howitzer.
Oh, sure. Uh-huh.
Or the VFW post, I think, had a tank that they got from somewhere. But that was one thing. Whereas all the stuff was left in Europe.
Right.
So these museums just have everything. They have all these things. And so to really viscerally get an idea of what happened, I think you really do have to go there and see it. And it really made me more interested in going back and actually visiting some of the World War I sites, because I've never really been to a World War I battlefield. I think that's going to be a very different experience, because it wasn't as dynamic a war. You didn't have...
No, not at all.
It was just a lot of stationary bombing each other. A lot of people go to Europe and they're going to Paris, Berlin, London. And this was really the first time, I've been traveling a very long time. I've done a ton of episodes on your show.
Right.
This was one of the very first times I've done a trip that was thematic.
And that wasn't a UNESCO World Heritage Site, at least.
Right. Well, you go to a place and then you see things at that place, wherever they may be. And maybe it's an ancient ruin. Maybe it's something from the 19th century, whatever. But for this, I just focused on the World War II aspects, and it's a very different kind of trip, because I'd never really done something like that anymore. And I think that in general, I would want to do another trip like this at some point in the future.
Well, and we should say, too, there are some sites in Italy, and that would have been predated the sites that you went to by another year.
Correct.
So that the liberation starts earlier than that, but doesn't get that far from Italy. Excellent.
The invasion of Italy took place beforehand, and that could be considered part of the liberation route.
Sure. Well, Italy's already knocked out of the war by the time D-Day happens. So I'm trying to think of what makes sense in terms of my usual questions. I don't know that I will necessarily ask you what's the prettiest site you went to. What's the most visually interesting site you went to as a photographer?
It is the German War Cemetery that I visited in the town of Yeselton. A very big cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
There's 40,000 people buried there. Still maintained, but they had the central area that was these trees that kind of were over all the branches, had the path, made a little tunnel. And yeah, it was very, very interesting. There's 32,000 soldiers from World War II and 85 from World War I, all in 28 acres.
Hmm.
So that's a lot of bodies, but still a very interesting place.
Well, then those dark crosses that you're seeing there look just like the German cemetery that I visited outside of Ypres in Flanders in Belgium. Interesting.
Yeah, I think there's a style. And just to kind of tie this in with my last appearance on the show, the location I found out while I was in Switzerland, much of the marble for the American tombstones comes from Switzerland.
Oh, I didn't know that. Huh.
That's what they told me. It's a very particular type of very white marble that they use.
Interesting. Well, Gary, do you want to summarize this trip in three words for us, and then we'll call it done?
Eye-opening, okay. Interesting, and historic.
Excellent.
I don't know if everyone can do the entire route like I did, but certainly I think parts of it and maybe some of the parts that you might not be familiar with. Everyone's familiar with Normandy, but some of the Belgian and Dutch sites would definitely be worth people's while making a stop.
Excellent. And if we wanted to send them to a particular post at everything-everywhere.com, your home base, where would we send them?
Go to everything-everywhere.com, and by the time this episode is out or people listen to it, I may have stuff posted. I just got back from my trip, so I haven't written it yet.
Hopefully, by then, we'll have a link in the show notes to whatever great post Gary has written by then. So
I'm definitely going to be doing a guide to visiting American cemeteries in Europe, because there are actually quite a few from both world wars, as well as doing a general overview of the liberation route, and then a special article I want to do on Nijmegen. Because I do believe that Sunset March is really a special thing. And if you are a veteran, if you have a family member who is a veteran, it's something that I would definitely consider doing if you're in the Netherlands.
Excellent. If you do an article about American cemeteries in Europe, the one that I would encourage you to look into is the American Cemetery in Russia. One of those forgotten cemeteries from the Americans who went over after World War I to try and intercede in the Russian Revolution.
I remember that from history. I didn't know there was a cemetery there.
I believe there is. I couldn't tell you where it is, though. Excellent. Well, our guest again has been Gary Arndt from everything-everywhere.com. Gary, thanks for coming back on the show in just a very short period of time and telling us about your trip and your love for history in Western Europe on the Liberation Route.
Thanks for having me.
In news of the community, I heard from Peter, who responded to an older episode, 521 on Greenland. I left his thoughts as a comment on that particular episode, but what he said is, I just returned from a hiking camping trip to Greenland run by the WWF, that's the World Wildlife Federation, and I thought your guest was remiss in not mentioning some of the hazards your guest should be prepared for. Greenland is stunningly beautiful and unique, but solo travelers need to be prepared for certain risks. One, polar bears. During the end of the summer, they are ravenously hungry and aggressive. Our hiking group of 10 had two guides, both armed with flares and shotguns. One would scout ahead during our hikes. On our first night, camped on the edge of the Smermalik Fjord, they had to kill a bear outside the village of Tinikalak across the fjord from us because it was threatening the village and a pair of hikers from Kulusuk. Kayaking among the icebergs. Very pretty, but beware of the hazards. 90% of the berg is below the water, and because they melt faster from the bottom, they often become top-heavy and roll over, which is very dangerous for kayaks and zodiacs nearby. So give them a very wide berth. Medical evacuation is difficult in an emergency because of weather and fog. One of our guests developed internal bleeding. Luckily, two guests were doctors and very nearly died because weather prevented helicopter access for 36 hours. We had a satellite phone. They sell them in the supermarkets in Greenland, and any solo hiker should carry one. Peter, thanks so much for the comments. With that, we're going to end this longer episode of Amateur Traveler. Remember that we are trying to decide where to go in 2020 for the Amateur Traveler trip, and we're signing up people for 2019 for the trip to South Africa, Botswana, and Victoria Falls. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. Use the same email address if you'd like to sponsor the Amateur Traveler, and thanks so much for listening. I got to see one more cathedral. I got to sit in one more cafe. I know that I should be heading home, but maybe not, maybe not today.
Hello, it is your partner, Big Boy, interested in giving back to your community while making new connections in your neighborhood. Introducing Neighbor to Neighbor, a California volunteers network that empowers you to take action, contribute to local needs, and be a part of something bigger than yourself. Visit c8neighbors.com to learn more about how you can get to know your neighbor and strengthen your community. Neighbor to Neighbor, it takes a neighborhood. Hello. Hello, it is your partner, Big Boy. Interested in giving back to your community while making new connections in your neighborhood? Introducing Neighbor to Neighbor, a California volunteers network that empowers you to take action, contribute to local needs, and be a part of something bigger than yourself. Visit c8neighbors.com to learn more about how you can get to know your neighbor and strengthen your community. Neighbor to Neighbor, it takes a neighborhood. Hello.